said that you felt that that Mountbatten had this belief that his officers were better professional sailors than he was.
I think it's a fair. I think it's a fair. I think it's one that he would admit himself if he would put it to him. It seems a bit short when we come and go down. If we had not really nothing to say to individual officers when you know, we all sort of semi-paraded to speak to him, but always had something to say to the sailors, which was marvellous for us. No doubt in Spartan. And I thought the reason was that he wasn't a very competent professional sailor. I know nothing about his judgment as a signal officer, which of course he was. But any signalman who had served underneath him thought he was an absolute god. And it figured as the man was. And we spent long periods away from Malta, all around the Mediterranean. I was conscious in the Middle East and also in Greece that the services there we met with and we were exercising with, and we were trying to build up NATO, you see, in the Mediterranean, was that they all wanted to meet Mountbatten. So he was very great in that respect. Whether he chose to use polo ponies for it or anything else, we didn't mind in the slightest. And the Turks, we persuaded the Turks to join NATO at that time, so we weren't too keen on it. He was in the lead and encouraging us. We went to Turkey and did exercises in Gallipoli. About that. So I had that impression, and I was very proud to serve underneath him. And he did remember me because he, as I said, he actually came to Lourdes once with his secretary, who was a great friend of mine, a naval captain, and brought him along to Lourdes. And that's a thing. And of course, the naval frigate he was in, first sea lord, if not sea defence star, I don't know exactly when. He was as he looked as the only person he recognised was me. Ah, sir. That's what he said.
So your next appointment was after you, this further first appointment, yes, as first lieutenant, was to what, John?
The time is right. Well, the most important thing, of course, was that I was promoted to commander.
And when would that have been?
It was the most important date of my life. It was 55 December. And I finished this command. I'd been in the Royal Marines, and I had the English Warfare Squadron, so I had quite a lot of experience behind me. My actual position at the time, when I was promoted, I must have been at the the amphibious school, Royal Navy amphibious school.
Right.
And then there I was. I was on what they called the dry list. There were two lists for promotion. The wet list was the ones who were going to continue in command posts. And the dry list were those who were going to be administrators, etc. Either ashore, unlikely to be afloat, which is why it was called the dry list. And I was on the dry list, and really much relieved to be promoted at all. So when I said earlier that I was lucky in that respect. And then in this capacity, I had some very, very good jobs. I didn't mind my appointment as Admiralty at all. Worked in the personnel division and had that experience with the
Second Sea Lord.
Second Sea Lord and the what do they call it? The press, anyway, on the political side, or union. It was either naval secretary or something else. And I enjoyed that experience immensely. And I was responsible for various aspects of a naval racing's career, which I not much enjoyed. And I think I knew a lot about naval racing structure, which I had a hand in when political decisions had to be made about this aspect and that aspect. And the particular branch for which I was personally responsible, rather nice, in the Admiralty, you still had some responsibility. It wasn't just command. And I was responsible for the regulating branch. Master arms, regulating petty officers, punishments in the Navy, chaplains underneath me. it was that aspect of the service which people passed by quite happily without contacting him. But the regulating branch and the master's arms, they were responsible for the discipline in ships, and they were responsible that sailors behave themselves, and that was a great responsibility. And their career pattern, we wanted to have a career pattern for these people, which I talked about or commented on, and I think I improved that career pattern. I can't remember exactly how it happened. But it is.
And how long did you work in the Admiralty?
2 years.
And after that?
And then I went to Singapore as commander of the barracks, which was second in command. And of course there I met a whole team of regulators and rascals and recruits that came in, you see. Wanted to know about this, that and the other. And I knew that I didn't make a song that this was the job on which my promotion to captain depended. I got help from the commander-in-chief staff and friends of mine, and they were mostly contemporaries of mine, unless I made a success of that job. So I made a success that I would be promoted. And I noticed that the chap who was there before me got promoted to captain, and the chap who was there after me got promoted to captain. And that's a coverage of about 6 years. But I didn't resent it in the slightest. I thought it was quite fair. I was probably a very good pilot, but the general administration and leadership, I was not practiced or experienced at. I never resented being passed over. I didn't like it. But, the Admiralty chose whom it wanted to, and or depended on their background and a very recent effort.
And when did you go to Singapore?
62.
So you are now 42?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Now 42.
And?
Which is relatively old for that.
Was it?
2 years, yes. Because my predecessor and my successor were younger.
And they went on to be captain, but you were irritated but didn't. We're not resentful of the fact that you...
I wasn't resentful because I was reasonably ambitious. I had a family. But I was conscious of my feelings, but I couldn't lay a finger on it. Like that. And most of my reports were good because they were read out to me. They were little snippets, as well, say. They were promising. I was thought not to be very punctual. Well, certainly by the time I was commander of the barracks, I was very punctual because the master of arms made sure I was, you see. He was directly underneath me. But I knew I had this job, and I didn't come up to scratch. I think it's a fair comment. And I wasn't resentful. And when I got back to England, I was sent for by the Second Sea Lord again. Who was Hill Norton, if the name means anything. It
certainly does.
And he had been out in Singapore with his fleet. He was FO2, I think they called it. And I had apparently, unaware at the time, looked after him very well when he came ashore and he got his wife out from England, that sort of thing. And she lived in some. I had an accommodation for senior officers in a special side. And he was obviously enjoyed the experience of being there, which was he thanked me at the time. So he was disappointed. that there hadn't been promotion. And I said, well, I know the race is getting faster, so. And there are more people in it than there used to be. So I'm sad and disappointed, but I'm not in any way resentful. By this time, I was at the Royal Air Force Staff College. An appointment there which suited me admirably. I was a flyer. I'd done the Naval Staff College, which I much enjoyed. And I was tentatively offered this, and I said, that sounds marvelous. And made a lot of old friends, because I'd trained in the Air Force for a year there, and very much enjoyed it. And the whatever they call the senior officer of the Staff College, president or something like that, director, was absolutely incensed when I wasn't promoted. And said, he said, well, who can I speak to in the Admiralty? And I said, well, you can try the second sea lord if you like. He said, I will. And by Jove, he did. The deputy was Admiral Crowley, whom I liked very much indeed. I said to the president, well, look, if you want a man-to-man talk, get Admiral Crowley, his deputy. But if you want to blow your trumpet, then try the second. He knows me perfectly well. And all about it. So that was a nice effort for the RAF, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. And you've, in what you've said, you've half answered a question that was in the back of my mind. Because you come back from Singapore aged 44, 45,
yes,
I assume.
Yes.
You probably know, or soon after you get back, you realise that you're not going to achieve further promotion,
yes,
and you've had the interview with Hill Norton, and you're 45 and you have a family. Did you ever consider at that stage leaving the service and spending, say, 20 years in business or whatever it may be, which might have offered you a better financial reward, if nothing else? Did that ever cross your mind?
It did very much, because in the Admiralty we had a character called the Employment Liaison Officer. I don't know when that was set up, but it hadn't been set up for long. And they gave me a wide range of opportunities where I might approach it. But one of the jobs that Hill Norton said, I remember quite well, and this is one of the things that certainly kept me in the Navy, was that he wanted to know, I said, well, I can go into naval intelligence, perhaps, or I can go to training. I'd like to do both those. And he rang up the appointments, those officer appointments, and said, what vacancies you've got in the naval attaché field? And they said, I'm afraid we've just filled this one and that one. He said, well, what, he picked on one, which I'll come to later, and said, well, stop it and send Sir down the telephone. Honk. So I was sent to Bangkok as naval attaché.
And this would be after your posting for the RAF?
Yes, yes. And that was a thrilling prospect.
What year roughly was that, John? Just to
I know exactly. I went there in 67.
So 67 to Bangkok?
Yes. I was 62 to 67 in Singapore, and I picked up Bangkok in 60. And there's a year in there somewhere for the RAF Staff College. But 67 to Bangkok. No doubt about that. And my wife came. And she was marvellous.
And did Hill Norton, do you think, was there a suggestion possibly that Hill Norton sent you to Bangkok because it was a consolation prize is too strong a word to use, but it was a special posting for someone who even he considered, who even he thought might have been possibly I wouldn't say ill served, but disadvantaged slightly.
Rewarded, if you like, isn't that the word? Well, I think he did that, the way he handled it straight away. Because he could see more good in me, or more use than he didn't want to kill me off forever. There was nothing else I would have wanted to do. Except I probed the, because you asked the question, the commercial prospects for a job for me. And I was interviewed by Steve Evans at that moment. I wasn't going to turn down Bangkok if I had to, even if I had the power to do so, which I doubt. So that was an enormous relief, and I felt at that moment that I owed it. So we say to the Navy and the people concerned, the second sea lords and the officer appointment chap, to make something of it. Which I like to think I did. I wasn't conscious of doing anything special. I did what the ambassador wanted and refused to embark me. Really, he ticked me off. Did I tell you that?
It's something we can come on to. But I think that you haven't mentioned, I think, something you have said to me, that Bangkok was the senior Far East posting for naval attaché at that time with the Vietnam War at its height.
Would that be correct? It was an important one from that point of view, but in fact, Japan was the highest. I don't pretend it was anyone else. And of course, you see, we had high commissioners in Malaya and Singapore still. So you would have a chap attached to the High Commissioner. And I was a well-established British, line of administration and understanding. And it was good in Ravine because I had to tell the Thai Navy intelligence what we were doing in Singapore. Now that was highly, I won't say secret, but very important.
You had to tell the Thai Naval Intelligence Service.
I was naval attaché.
Why did you have to do that?
I appointed the naval attaché to the embassy in Bangkok. I was also appointed as advisor to the Thai Navy. It was an unusual situation. I didn't think it was unusual. If you sent a naval attaché to India or Pakistan, you would expect them to advise on their navy as well. So now, what was the actual question you asked me? The importance of Bangkok as an appointment?
Yes,
well,
really.
Certainly the Vietnam War was on.
Yes.
And there were questions which were sometimes asked me about our involvement in it, because the Australians were, so were the New Zealanders. But in fact, we were not, if I remember exactly. Although we get a very careful watch on proceedings, which I tried to explain to the Thai Navy in my own language, as to what exactly that meant. I said, well, we've got ships all the way up the Malay coast. We can still visit those without asking diplomatic permission. But if I would like naval ships to come up here. But I'll have to ask your permission, which is called diplomatic terms. And we had lots of visits from Singapore Command up to Thailand. So I had been the link of establishing a new liaison between the Thai Navy, which was expanding, and ourselves. And although I must have put it in one or two reports, a new relationship has been established. Well, that was what naval attaches were for. Does that answer some of your
it does.
Questions?
It does. I think you also represented British industry to a small degree.
Well, this thing came to us as attaches, which must have been general, is that we'll promote the sale of British military equipment. Military includes naval in that respect. Well, I was huffed by the ambassador, who was my boss, because he once said to me, under whose command are you? And I said, Your Excellency, you and nobody else. He said, I don't believe the other people. I said, well, I promise you, as far as I'm concerned, it's you. We've been friends for years and years. He said that he didn't like the promotion of sales of military equipment. And I ought to discourage the Thai Navy from buying. But I said, sir, I'm saying this to you. It's also, I promise I said to him, said to you, better get a new naval attaché. And that fixed it. He was smaller than me, as most people are, and he smoked a pipe. And he walked down in front of me puffing his pipe and said, oh, all right. I'll never forget that, but he said, all right. And we got, there was quite an effort made by the shipbuilders in England to get overseas contracts. Vosper's is a famous one, you may know, but also with the Arrows on the Clyde. Well, being half Scots, thanks to Molyneux. And they had a new frigate. It was called the Arrow Frigate, their own design, and it had gas turbines. So what did I do? Well, the first thing to try, they would say, we know nothing about gas turbines. Well, I said, well, I can arrange for some of your top people to go to be trained in England. And of course, they were thrilled about this. And I did. I mean, I merely got them to the makers, whatever they were, and said, would you include these people? And they did. And then there was a, I suppose, an amusing sequence. And so next year they said, would I draw up the complement of the ship? Do you know what that means?
No. Tell me, please.
Total number of sailors, officers, and men, and specialisation required in this new frigate. Well, I had been drafting commander in the Navy, so ratings, careers, and prospects seemed to be easier. So I drew up the complement of a Yarrow frigate, including the number of attached required on there. I said to them, well, you've got to tell me what equipment you want on it. And they tell me, machinery, gas turbines, anti-aircraft guns, main armament, because I knew it all. And I said, I think you better go to, before I go any further, you better go to the Arrows on those deals. And he said, well, we'll send our attaché from London to do that. And I said, well, go there, because he will ask what you want to know in more detail. And a stroke of extraordinary life. The attaché is all very extraordinary, but it was, at that moment, it was crucial. The Thai naval attaché.
Yes, I'm sorry, John, please continue.
Very wise, and by the Thai Navy. The attaché in London had been English trained. And, of course, quite a number of the Thai admirals had been Dartmouth trained. So I put that in, and said, this is a good thing to continue, but we don't any longer. But we used to train foreign officers as well as Dartmouth. So the whole thing was made easy. And they signed the contract. And if I wobbled a lot, I'm sorry, but my brother at that time was head of the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank. And he rang me up in Bangkok from Hong Kong, which was pretty difficult. I think he went up to the North Pole and back again. And said, well, I will guarantee the down payment on behalf of the Thai Navy. I should thank heavens for this. They had to put a down payment, you see, for the contract. And the Arrows went ahead and built them. I forget, it was similar to the Malay. The Malays had helped a bit by buying one. But Thais were having those made to their own requirements. And I said, when they asked for chandeliers in the senior officer's cabin, put chandeliers, it's more important than might have been. And they were thrilled. Molly and I went to the launching in Scotland on the ground. And not only did they buy one, they bought two. And of course, all the other industries, anyway, in Scotland, got in on the act. I mean, the people who built boats and lights and fittings and that sort of thing.
Did you have to demonstrate a ship to them? Did that have to take place?
No, the nearest thing we came to that was I got the CNC of the Thai Navy invited to Singapore. This was in the time of Sir William O'Brien, and I call him, he lives down here now, who was Commander-in-Chief of the fleet in Singapore. And I wrote extensively to his staff saying, these people are wanting to buy British ships. Have you any gas turbine? And he said, no, but they haven't, but he's got one coming. But they laid on a vast fleet demonstrating, took them right out to sea and back again. This was the commander-in-chief of the Thai Navy, probably like the first Sea Lord going somewhere, and some of his staff. And he was extremely well. But when the fleet commander said, what do I include in my speech? I said, well, don't forget, sir, I'm sure you know that you have sent British ships to Thailand, I'll say by the half dozen at a time, but hardly a month's rent, and how extremely well they were looked after by the Thai Navy. It's almost every month. It was a great thrill for me and an ambassador to have them, but it was thanks to the Thai Navy that all this was possible. And he brought almost the exact words into the speech. So that is what naval attaches are for.
That's what they were for.
I think, really. Stand up, show ambassador.
Were you sorry to leave Bangkok or not?
Well, it coincided with me ending my naval career. So the whole thing was a distressing, I think. Except for one another thing, which I was helped immensely by. The new Second Sea Lord then was Derek Empson, who'd been a flyer like me. He confided in me that they had a new system of encouraging officer material. And we started up an organization called the Senior School Liaison Officer. How about one of those jobs? Can I find out more about it? And he said, John, it's right up your street. We are targeting the sixth forms of independent schools and undergraduates actually at the university. And going alongside will be the university liaison officer working with you, and you will have a certain air of England as the senior school's liaison. And it's having to take in the air I was given, having to take in my own school and schools that I knew very well, and Dauntless down here, but I hadn't actually bought a house down here. And my job was to go into the school and first of all give them their career, a career pattern for the Royal Navy. And in many ways we were lacking in this respect, the Navy was. The Army and Air Force had a much better career pattern, which included sending them and paying them to go to university. And I was pressured as hard, and would I send them to university? And I had to say, I told this to the second at the time, that it seemed to me that all the boys were interested in was getting their university career paid for. And I found it not difficult, but time-consuming, to explain that they were actually joining the Navy. And all of that contained. He said, I reckoned I had it right. So that was quite an enjoyable testing time. Because the schools were the top public schools of England. It so happened to Rector, like, you can't just have command, you must have responsibility. He kept Eton and Harrow for himself. And I remember saying to him, I know him, you're welcome. But I had Westminster, I had all the schools. I was given the Midlands of England, which the Navy decides where the beginning and the end of the Midlands are. For example, I had Truro Cathedral School, which is about as far southwest as you can get, and a lovely school in Norfolk called Holt. Norfolk, how about that? And that was how the Admiralty divided England. It was a marvellous experience.
But you touched on a comment you made at the end of your, apropos of the end of your service in Bangkok, that you were disappointed at the way your service career ended.
Well, of course, it stopped dead. I wasn't going to get any further. It coincided with it, but I already knew that it had ended, that I wouldn't go any further.
After Singapore, really?
Yes. I mean, I knew I had another three. We had to retire at 50. You see, and there I was, 47. So for my last 3 years, it was pretty good, really, to get that Bangkok appointment. And I think it was through Hill Norton, and I remained extremely grateful and determined to make a proper success of the job. Such as it was, I hardly knew what it was going to be, but one of them was to sell military equipment.
Yes.
But I crossed with my ambassador, yes, and we made even better friends.
And so you then, so you left the Navy and went on to the school's liaison.
Yes, it was. It was also, it was what they called an RO job, but it was a status, RO, retired officer job, and I had entirely civil service